Apologies for the ads. As an independent one-woman show, ads help me recover some of my costs. If you want to skip the ads, sign up to the exclusive feed. All episodes are free from ads, and there's full-length bonus episodes as well. The link is in the show notes. You can also make a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/amillionOTW. And on with the show, as they say.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Cindy changed her name, unlisted her phone number, and moved from Vancouver to Richmond. But no matter what she did, the harassment continued.
This is probably the most baffling case that I've ever come across. One that's kept me awake at nights. I know anybody who's come across this case, the jurors, the coroner's people, police officers who I've talked to, everybody has lain awake at night thinking, can this be? Can somebody have done this to themselves? Can somebody be out there lurking still and have never been caught?
They will be trying to find out if she was murdered or if she committed suicide.
The question is, how do you tie your hands behind your own back and then kill yourself?
And they're willing to keep investigating, but I don't think they're ever going to find a killer. I now believe it's a suicide.
I believe it's a murder, yes.
When we left off in part two, Cindy James, who was actually at that time still going by Cindy Makepeace, she had been attacked in Dunbar Park while walking her dog Heidi by a man and a woman in a green van. She also had agreed at the urging of Ozzy to try hypnotherapy for a second time to try and come up with some more details about her most recent attack. In January of 1985, Cindy did undergo this hypnosis, but as earth-shattering as what she revealed is, I'm going to kind of skim over it because I personally don't really believe much in hypnosis and repressed memory recovery. It's just a personal thing. If you disagree, then you can just take it as evidence in one direction or another of Cindy's personal torture and the trauma that she was going through. Anyways, she told the psychologist that while on vacation in Thornby Island in July of 1981, they had rented a cabin out there. Cindy and Roy had gone out on their boat, which actually already seems a little bit odd because Cindy didn't like the water. She couldn't swim, so she wasn't known to have shared Roy's love of boating and was always kind of reluctant to go. Anyways, she remembers, which I say in air quote, that Roy was, while on the boat, he murdered and dismembered a man and a woman that she didn't know and had smeared blood from one of them onto her face. Now, I'm not saying that Cindy's outright lying about this. I think that Cindy was susceptible to false memories because of the trauma that she was experiencing and the pressure that she felt to remember things. So anyways, the police did look into it, but there was no evidence of any missing persons or evidence of anything really gruesome like that have happened around the time or any time really. And Cindy's sister was also apparently on that trip. I don't think that she was on the boat, but was staying at the cabin. She doesn't remember anything strange or Cindy being kind of wigged out about anything at the time. However, to be fair, witnessing something so awful would likely make a person disconnect from themselves and push those memories down into subconscious. It might even cause one to have some mental instability later in life. It would be super bad, but I don't think that it happened, at least not like she was remembering it. There might have been a man and a woman with them. There might have been an argument or something, but I don't believe that a murder took place. So we are going to move on to something that did happen in June of 1985. And this is something that we know for sure happened. And that was that Cindy was committed against her wishes to the Lionsgate Hospital because she actually attempted to kill herself by taking a large number of prescription pills. Now, just to circle back a little bit to this hypnosis thing. Police put a wire on Cindy's phone and she called Roy to confront him about this memory that she had. He, of course, denied it and called her crazy and that she was involved in an enormous revenge fantasy against him. And they continued their surveillance on both Cindy and Roy for a while after that, but nothing happened.
Are you denying it?
My God. I am certainly denying it. I always have denied it. I have absolutely nothing whatever to do with it.
The reason I circled back to it is because it's been sort of hinted at that Roy was the one that had her committed after her accusations, but she didn't stay for very long and claimed that she wasn't actually trying to kill herself, but regardless, she was back home by July 2nd when she recorded her call with Roy. And apparently while in the hospital, she had written in her journal that she felt that death was kind of her only option and that she, when she got out, she was planning on following through with suicide. But this was in 1984, and she didn't actually die until 1989. She then got a package on her doorstep with a note saying, "Blood flowing freely," and in the package was a pair of black nylons, just like the ones that were often found tied around her neck during these physical attacks. On July 27th, she found a makeup compact on her porch, and inside of it was rotting meat. And then on August 5th, she called the police because there had been a fire in her house. It was only a small fire, so the fire department hadn't actually been called. But the police found bits of burnt newspaper in her front living room. And the same thing happened the very next day. Now, a couple of weeks later, on August 21st, a call came in at 4:45 a.m. because another fire had been set. Now, this one was actually in Cindy's basement bathroom. Ozzy had been called as well, and when he came out, Cindy had said that she had taken her dog, Heidi, for a walk at 3:15 a.m. and came home to find her house on fire. The window in the bathroom was found to be slightly ajar, like somebody had opened it, and there was bits of burnt paper this time as well. But, according to the police, the dust on the windowsill was undisturbed, leading them to believe that she had actually started the fire herself, or at least that the fire had been started from someone who had gotten into the house some other way. And this particular RCMP officer that outright believed that Cindy was the one that had started the fire herself was actually publicly named as Carol Halliday. She's so much did not believe Cindy that she had a psychologist, Dr. Anthony Marcus, sit down with Cindy and interview her, and not just interview her, but go through the case files, which by this time were like boxes of files. And before I talk about Dr. Marcus's findings, I should mention that it was pretty clear that Carol wasn't having any of Cindy's stories and was quoted as saying that the men on the force who had been working Cindy's file up to the point that she came along had been conned by the histrionics of a pretty woman. And Dr. Marcus was of the opinion that Cindy had this dissociative identity disorder, or DID, which back then, of course, we called multiple personality disorder, which he said was based on some childhood trauma. But interestingly, he never asked her about her early life in any of his interviews with her. On December 1st, Cindy once again moved out to Richmond near the University of British Columbia and changed her name from Makepeace to James, hoping that it would make her harder to find. But it didn't. On December 11th at 6 p.m. that evening, she was found in a ditch, in and out of consciousness, about 6 kilometers, or just under 4 miles from her new house. She was found by a passerby wearing men's work boots and only one single glove, and of course, a pair of nylons again around her neck. She was also suffering from hypothermia and needed to be rushed to the hospital, where they discovered that she had been drugged and had bruises and cuts on her body, but Cindy couldn't remember anything past her lunch date with a friend earlier that day. Cindy spent that Christmas in Germany visiting her brother Roger, and when she came back in January of 1986, she asked Agnes Woodcock, who was her friend and co-worker, and her husband Tom, to come and spend the night with her because she wasn't feeling safe in light of the fires and the last abduction. It wasn't particularly unusual for her to ask that of them. They were really good friends of Cindy's, and they spent the night on occasions after a late night, or sometimes just because. On one particular evening when Agnes and Tom were sleeping there on April 16th, Cindy woke them up in the middle of the night by her yelling that there was a fire in the basement, and they tried to call the fire department, but the phone lines were once again cut. So Tom ran across to another neighbor's, and when he ran out of the house, he says that he saw a man standing on the street outside of the house, but he ran away when Tom appeared outside of the door. Tom, Agnes, and Cindy all reported this as appearing like a firebomb or like a Molotov cocktail that had started the fire. And investigators did find signs of an accelerant being used, but it appeared to have been poured around the bookshelves and carpet inside the room where the fire had been, according to them. Cindy just kind of fell apart after this last fire. She moved in with Agnes and Tom for a while while her house was being fixed, and she stopped eating. She started to talk like she was really depressed and that life just wasn't really worth living anymore with the threats and intimidation, and was just always watching over her shoulder, but never able to avoid or escape the next attack. And then, of course, there was the matter of the police not believing her, probably talking about her behind her back, something she often wrote about in her diary. But remember back then, I think the episode before I mentioned that, after the first physical attack, she started to see a psychiatrist named Alan Connolly. Well, he always believed that Cindy was in fact being harassed and threatened, and never mentioned that he thought there was anything off in the slightest with Cindy or her behavior. But after this last incident, he was getting really worried about her that she might be suicidal. So he had Cindy committed for 10 days to the St. Paul's Hospital. And the doctors there found that she was now suffering from anorexia, not so much in the common need to be thin and in control of her body way that most women are, but just in that depressed, started to refuse to eat way. And by 1986, Cindy was 41 years old, so not young or like an immature woman. After a couple of days at St. Paul's, she was moved to Riverview, where a full workup was done on her. And the report just reads in part, "This 41-year-old woman on initial assessment was very resistant. She would only answer in one-word responses. She refused to discuss a number of topics and would give no eye contact. On the second date, her mood was considerably elevated. She had completed the other tests herself and was willing to talk. She seemed apprehensive as to how the tests could be used. She maintained good eye contact except when discussing the terrorizing incidences. She then would look down or cover her eyes and speak haltingly. She expressed upset and cried a great deal when relating these events. Patient kept asking if her responses to them indicated she was crazy. Her IQ is well above average. This type of individual can be characterized as negativistic and conforming. They have unpredicted moods, pessimism, sullenness, vacillating with social agreement and friendliness. They tend to anticipate and precipitate disappointments through their obstructive and negative behavior. This type of person tends to be vulnerable to fears." And in my very unprofessional opinion, that sounds just like any one of us. It would make sense that she would be very depressed and sullen and concerned about how her mental health was perceived by others. And it totally makes sense that she would seem paranoid and negative. I'm just not reading anything in there that gives me that kind of aha moment over Cindy's demeanor or her mental stability that wouldn't be expected. Unless the writer is trying to hint that looking down, covering her eyes when talking about specific events was indicative of lying. I'm not a body language professional, so we don't really know. But the writer also doesn't appear to be hinting that she's prone to dramatics or making things up or wanting attention at a sociopathic level that would be required to be making all of this up.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
But she did try to escape from St. Paul's by running down the stairs. She didn't make it out, and then she was transferred to Riverview. So she was clearly going through some stuff. Anyway, she was deemed okay after 10 days to be let out and then admitted to her dad, Otto, that she had been keeping some information from him, from the police and pretty much anyone, including Ozzy, that she did in fact know who was behind all of this insanity and terrorizing, but would not name the person or persons because she was just too terrified. And by the midsummer in 1987, Cindy was actually fired from her job at Bellum House because they just felt the incidents were never going to stop and it was starting to affect her job. She didn't take that very well because she'd loved her job and the kids, and of course, the workers at Bellum House were told not to have any further contact with her. So you could say she was rather depressed and starting to feel pretty hopeless, which triggered the move and the new name, and she did get a new job at Richmond Hospital. But even with that new job, the new name, and new digs in Richmond, everything just kind of continued as it had been. At the end of August, her back window was broken. And then on the 31st of August, her front porch light bulb had been loosened. And then a week later, somebody tried to cut a hole in her basement window with a glass cutter. And then things were either quiet or she'd stopped reporting the more minor stuff because nothing's reported to have happened between early September 1987 and February of 1988. And then there was another broken window, and then quiet or at least unreported incidents again until October 11th of 1988. And that is when Roy himself got two calls on his answering machine, that hoarse voice whispering Cindy did dead meat soon, and the other one suggesting a motive of sorts. Quote, "More smack, more downers, another grand after we waste the cunt. No more deal." Now, because they were on his answering machine, he had the recordings, but he wasn't particularly trustful of the police, who probably wouldn't have believed them or would somehow try to connect the incidents back to him again. So instead, he gave them to his lawyer. Then on October 25th, the police received notice from the panic alarm that Cindy carried with her. And when they got to the house, they found her in the garage with a nylon, this time tying up her hands. Her watch band had been cut when I was lying on the driveway, along with her car keys. Now, some reports say she was hogtied, but not all the reports do. But this time her pants and underwear were down around her ankles with her hospital ID still clipped to the pants. She was apparently in a coma, but I can't verify that. She might have just been unconscious, though. She was interviewed the next day. She didn't remember anything specific about the words her attacker had used. She just said that she thought he must have put a knife to her neck and threatened to kill her. She didn't remember actually being tied up. But then she did remember sensing that there was another man there as well that was sort of beside the car, maybe behind it, a voice that she said was coming somewhere from on her right side.
"I just stepped one foot out the door.
"I don't know where he came
not what I thought it was going to do. But it was trying to push this knife open or something. And he said, and I don't know exactly what he said, I couldn't hear, said, it sounds like snuffer, which doesn't make sense. And then I felt something over my mouth and my right arm being pulled back. I remember thinking, oh my God. And then I don't think I really remember anything else.
Interestingly, there were two pubic hairs that didn't match Cindy's found on her body. But without DNA technology, there really wasn't anything that they could do with it. But the RCMP did hire a mountain climber and knot expert, Robert Chisnall, to analyze the knots on the nylon stocking that she was so often tied up with. At the time, Chisnall concluded that it was highly unlikely that Cindy would have been able to secure the knots herself. But I think that testimony was later a bit debunked. That it would be somewhat difficult, but not impossible. Anyways, then in January 1989, so she had a few months of not too much happening before she moved her insurance agent, Richard Johnson, into her basement suite. At this time, there was no romantic stuff going on between the two of them, but she felt safer having somebody living there that she knew and trusted. Now, this was a life insurance, not home and auto policies that he was an agent for. And Cindy did have a life insurance policy, and I believe her parents were the beneficiary. And it wasn't like a huge policy, it was just a regular sized policy. A couple of months later, one of the security guards at Richmond General, where she was now working, found a note with those creepy cut and paste letters saying, "Soon, Cindy." And that same day on her windshield was another note saying, "Sleep well." And then on April 29th, she had a break-in at her home, so the RCMP used dogs to try and track a scent, but they found nothing. Then again on May 10th, 1989, she had another break-in. That time the dogs found a track that led over the back fence of her yard, but they couldn't find sort of the end of the trail or who or where it led to. Then around 4 p.m. on May 25th, 1989, Cindy picked up her paycheck from the hospital and talked to a coworker who reported that she seemed in pretty good spirits, and then she went and got some groceries, and she also went to the Bank of Montreal at the Blundell's Shopping Center, and there she was witnessed in line to use the bank's ATM machine, and she deposited her paycheck at 7:58 p.m. During the day, she had an infrared camera installed at her house, and she made plans for Agnes and Tom Woodcock to come over that night to play bridge, and they were also going to spend the night with her there, which they often did to help her feel a bit safer. The Woodcocks arrived at her house at 10 p.m., and the house was dark and quiet, and her Chevy was missing from the carport. Her new roommate, Richard Johnson, who's the insurance agent, told the Woodcocks that she had mentioned she was going to go do some shopping. So they drove to the Blundell Mall and drove around the parking lot looking for her because they knew that that was the mall closest to her house and the one that she used most of the time for her errands. And there they found Cindy's car, but no Cindy. So fearing the worst, they went right to the Richmond RCMP office and reported her missing. The police did come out and check out the car. According to reports, there was a small amount described as a droplet of blood inside the car and on the driver's side door. There were groceries in bags, but they weren't from Safeway, which was the grocery chain that was actually located in the Blundell Mall, and a gift that was wrapped, which was for her friend's son's birthday. Her debit card and the transaction slip of her deposit were found underneath the car. The car was also locked, with her purse still inside. And what's interesting is that the groceries that were bought were not Safeway branded items. It was later learned that she had shopped somewhere else for the groceries, but it was the Blundell Mall where she used the ATM. Then when back at her house, nothing appeared out of the ordinary. The Canadian Coast Guard searched the river near the area, but they came up with nothing. And a few days later, Richard Johnson, who's that insurance agent again, his secretary received a phone call from a man saying that he was Cindy's father, asking about her insurance policy. But she told him that he's going to have to come into the office to discuss it in person, at which case he hung up. Otto said he never made that call, and they had no reason to believe that Cindy was dead at that time. So Cindy has vanished, and we are almost done, I promise, but there is still the matter of finding Cindy, and then the findings and the beginning of the real mystery here. Yes, we haven't even gotten to that part yet, and all these happenings are mysterious, but it's about to get even weirder. So there is a part four, and yes, there will probably be a part five, and I still don't have a clear theory, but we're going to get there. I am not putting in all this work and research for nothing. I am going to get to the bottom of this. So to be continued. In the meantime, I appreciate you so much for listening. I hope you're still listening, and I hope that you've been enjoying this bit. We're almost done. We're going to get this done. As always, thank you so much for listening.
The world of 911 emergency dispatching is brutally diverse. One minute you can be talking with someone about parking violations.
What's the process we are to take to have people towed? Because it's actually delaying the mail.
And then all hell can break loose. Then the rest of the day is crazy. We could have murders.
Hill County 911, what's your emergency?
I just killed my children.
Home invasions.
He's in my house.
I shot him.
You shot him?
He was coming up towards me and I shot him.
Natural disasters.
Tornado came through and got us. I'm buried under a bomb to all my life.
Even bombings. My show, Music City 911, will put you in the dispatcher's chair, put you ear to ear with the callers and responders, and keep you on edge from start to finish. I hope to both educate and entertain, as I'm a 911 dispatcher with over 20 years experience. And just like dispatching, every episode is different from the last. Music City 911. Real 911 calls, real 911 dispatchers. Available to listen to on any podcast app.
Refresh your home today at Menards with window images, blinds, and shades. We have everything you need for updating your window treatments. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Save big on window treatments at Menards. Plus, get them cut to width in-store for free. Visit Menards.com and view our entire selection of window treatments today. Plus, the weekly flyer and other great deals going on now. Save big.